Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming supplements of yesteryear, and as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. This is a special episode of Monster Man brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters, and specifically of Edwin King. Thank you very much, Edwin. Now, like everyone who's pledged to back the Patreon at the $5 or higher level, Edwin gets to choose a special episode, and he has asked me to talk not about a specific monster, but about a concept that I mentioned in an earlier episode, the pathetic aesthetic. So what is the pathetic aesthetic? Where does it come from? How does it inform gaming? And what does it contribute to monster design? These are the questions that I'll be addressing in this episode. I should add that Edwin is not merely a Patreon supporter, but also a sponsor of the second Monster Man contest. Voting is still open. I'll put a link in the show notes. Please go and pick your favorites from among the entries by our talented contestants. Okay, what is the pathetic aesthetic? So the term, as far as I can tell, kind of originated in the 80s and 90s as a response to changes in art and popular music, and it referred to there a trend away from like the highly theatrical, very produced, you know, sort of star musicians of the age, and a trend back toward a more like intimate, vulnerable portrayal of songwriters and musicians as people with a lot of flaws. So if you want to think about like unshaven musicians with straggly hair in the 90s, that would be examples of the pathetic aesthetic, right? Like the unraveling sweaters and whatever, as opposed to, you know, giant hair and a bunch of makeup. That is related to, but not exactly the same as the way that it gets used in gaming. And the use of the term pathetic aesthetic, I'm deriving, and I think most people are deriving, from a blog post on the blog Known World Old World. And I think it's, you know, I think even the title of that blog gives you some clue as to where the author, Bargle, is tending, because the Known World, of course, was the default setting of Dungeons & Dragons, and the Old World is the setting of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. And Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, in many ways, is the epitome of pathetic aesthetic gaming in its later stages. If you want a sense of what constitutes the pathetic aesthetic, I think it's not hard to find in gaming materials from the 70s and 80s, both American and British ones, although I think you could make a strong case that the pathetic aesthetic stays around longer in British gaming, and that British gamers in general maybe have a little bit more of a taste for engaging with this kind of, like, sad sack story, often with a level of ironic distance, not necessarily detachment, but distance, or, if you prefer, ironic subversion of heroic fantasy tropes. If you open an early advanced Dungeons & Dragons book, you will definitely see examples of the pathetic aesthetic at work. So, I mentioned this illustration before, but if you go back to the Monster Manual and look at the Dave Sutherland illustration that accompanies the ant, giant, you'll see an armored knight, like in full-on late medieval plate armor, desperately trying to fend off a swarm of ants with a sword and a torch, while his buddy lies on the ground being swarmed on by these creatures. It's two guys in a dark, low tunnel, desperately fending off a swarm of ants. I think we may contrast the pathetic aesthetic with what I'm going to call the heroic aesthetic, which is the dominant aesthetic of modern Dungeons & Dragons, right? If you take a look, for instance, at the 5th edition DM screen, what you will see is a group of adventurers who are, you know, tough and exciting and covered in magical trinkets and whatever, and they're about to face off with a real mean-looking red dragon, right? Clearly a heroic throwdown is about to happen here, an epic tale for the ages. In the Pathetic Aesthetic blog post, Bargle posits that one of the big differences is that in the transition from pathetic to heroic in gaming, the focus of awesomeness moved away from the setting and became focused on the characters. So in a pathetic aesthetic game, you are kind of scrubs who are exploring a world that is larger and more dangerous than you can comprehend, whereas in a heroic aesthetic game, you are larger-than-life inhabitants of a larger-than-life world. Now, I feel like those are extreme positions, and that most games actually sit somewhere in the middle, but I do think that that sense of being, you know, overwhelmed by the world around you is one that we can use to make interesting games, and that including a dose of this pathetic aesthetic in your D&D game or in your whatever game can help give it a fun and varied emotional tone. Now, the idea of the pathetic aesthetic is sometimes tied to challenge, right? The idea that, you know, oh, kids today have it easy, throwing around cantrips, right? Wizards can cast spells every turn, blah, blah, blah. In my day, we had one hit point and a sleep spell, and we had to, like, figure out our way around a room full of kobolds with nothing but, you know, half of a candle, a length of rope, and a pair of pinking shears. And you can see right away that there is a lot of fun in the idea of triumphing over adversity in straitened circumstances, even if that adversity is kind of absurdly not all that great, right? Outwitting one cop can be as much fun as, you know, fleeing from the entire city watch, you know, as in a big elaborate car chase with chicken trucks and stuff. You know, catching the kid who stole your bike can be as much fun as catching the person who stole the Hope Diamond if your bike is as important to you as the Hope Diamond. So I don't want to say that the pathetic aesthetic maps 100% onto the more ruthless mechanical environment of early Dungeons & Dragons, or a world where life is short, characters die and come back, and it is the dungeon that is persistent, not the people within it, right? In an old-school game, it would not be too uncommon to have a very large dungeon complex that different parties returned to at many different times, and that even you might find the same player playing multiple characters in explorations of the same dungeon. Whereas today, I think we would tend to see that the opposite would be true, that a D&D campaign is the story of a single persistent party moving through a wide range of different environments. But I don't think that that means that the pathetic aesthetic is necessarily tied into mechanical difficulty, and I'll give you an example actually that comes from the world of computer gaming. Now, as you know, at the beginning of many fantasy RPG video games, you get this kind of cliched encounter where you kill some rats in a sewer or something like that, right? We have a rusty short sword and worn leather armor, and you're fighting rats. And so I played this game called Jade Empire. Jade Empire was an action RPG. I played it on the Xbox. And you play a martial artist, a sort of a wuxia genre tale about, you know, a plucky youngster from a martial arts school who goes on to reveal the corruption at the heart of the empire. And at the very beginning, you're playing the best student in your master's martial arts school, and you're involved in a rivalry with another martial arts school. And you go out and you beat a bunch of these toughs from the bad guy martial arts school in a kung fu fight. Now, mechanically, this is exactly identical to fighting rats in a basement, right? You're fighting low-level opponents using only the simplest techniques. It's merely the narrative framing of the same, like, structure and mechanics that makes it feel completely different. You don't feel like a scrub fighting vermin in a basement. You feel like the biggest fish in your pond, you know, who is now about to move into a different pond. You know, you're the king of the beach here in this martial arts school, but, you know, then you're going to go out into the wider world and you're going to encounter all kinds of stuff you're not prepared for. So it sort of reverses the normal structure of the pathetic aesthetic, because if you think about, like, that rats in a basement thing, that's there, you know, partly to teach you the mechanics, but also partly to provide this emotional contrast that when you get to high level and you're running around, you know, shooting lightning out of your ears and jumping from cloud to cloud or whatever, and you think, ah, and to think I was once fighting rats in a basement. So here, the emotional valence is reversed, right? So we're, instead of saying, I started from the bottom and now I'm here, we're saying, wow, I thought I was big stuff, but it turns out there's more going on than I could ever have imagined. So I think that we can agree that these are both narrative tools rather than exclusive ways of looking at the world, right? That you can deploy the pathetic aesthetic even in a game that is not primarily pathetic. And the standard bearer of the pathetic aesthetic is Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, and there are certainly moments in any given Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay campaign that are just straightforwardly heroic or horrific, and that don't have that kind of, like, absurd element that informs the pathetic aesthetic, but they're all couched in a world that is generally dark and absurd. So the pathetic aesthetic is absurd and sad, and is about characters who are kind of like, who are kind of person-sized, you know, who aren't particularly larger than life and maybe even smaller than life. Conan is a heroic aesthetic character, but Kugel is a pathetic aesthetic character, even though, perhaps because, Kugel lives in a world that is much more outwardly fantastic than Conan and is arguably, in a sense, more powerful than Conan. So what are the advantages of the pathetic aesthetic as a game tool? I think that one of the key ones is the idea of relatability. Think about the genre of wartime autobiography, right? One of the things that you notice if you read eyewitness accounts from people who were in these kinds of dangerous situations is they very seldom perceive themselves as acting with heroic resolve, right? We tend to interpret the actions of people we identify as heroes as like, ooh, that's grim determination. But most of the time, if you listen to their account, it's either kind of desperation or chance. The emotions that they relate about their wartime experiences are often not, you know, blazing action, heroism, whatever, but simple, relatable human experiences of boredom, frustration, or fear. The things that many people remember about periods when even, you know, even periods when they were in real danger are the little things. I think that's a very relatable experience, right? We've all been in the middle of some very significant moment in our lives and found ourselves focused on the silly, the absurd, the embarrassing, in a word, the pathetic. And I think that that makes the pathetic aesthetic characters relatable. I don't think that heroic characters are intended to be relatable in some ways. They're intended to be aspirational, right? This is what I would be like if I were the chosen one, or this is the kind of person that I look up to. And Bargle takes the position that the pathetic aesthetic is a more mature worldview. I'm not 100% convinced of that argument, to say the least, but I do get the idea that, like, when I think of the, like, bunch of doofuses adventuring party, I definitely think, like, oh yeah, I can relate to that idea, right? Here's just, like, a bunch of clowns going into this dangerous environment, and they're probably going to mess it up. I feel like those characters are more identifiable with than larger-than-life heroic characters, at least for some people, right? I mean, the Coen Brothers model of D&D is a valid one. You can even have a strong aspect of the pathetic aesthetic in a directly heroic narrative. In comic book terms, you can think of this as the difference between Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby. Ditko's characters have the pathetic aesthetic. Not that I'm saying Kirby doesn't craft relatable characters. Well, okay, yeah, kinda. But they both have a place within an overall narrative. And it's certainly true that Ditko's evocation of, you know, the pathetic aesthetic in the life of Peter Parker is used to provide context and contrast for the heroic adventures of Peter's alter ego. So I guess I'm saying I don't think these two things necessarily are separate, even if we can add a dose of the pathetic aesthetic to make otherwise heroic characters seem a little more relatable. In general, though, the model of a modern D&D party seems to be that the characters are a band of heroes and not a bunch of losers and scoundrels. So much for player characters, and we're not really that interested in those guys on this show anyway. Let's talk about monsters and how monsters contribute to the pathetic aesthetic. And I think there are a lot of examples of monsters, which indeed, including ones that have survived into modern D&D, that encapsulate the pathetic aesthetics. Like that bit in The Simpsons where Homer Simpson jokes that he played Dungeons and Dragons for however many hours, and then I was slain by an elf. If he'd been slain by a dragon, it wouldn't have been as funny. He's slain by an elf, because that's the kind of thing Homer Simpson would get slain by. He's such a yutz that he can't even get killed by a monster that has some dignity. And that's what those poor swine down in that tunnel fending off the ants don't have. They don't have dignity. And Sutherland here makes a really interesting choice. Now, I don't think that this is intentional necessarily, but to put this guy in his shiny plate armor, fending off this swarm of ants with his longsword, right? You can imagine that he is thinking, this is not what I signed up for when I knelt in the chapel of the gods and the king dubbed me a knight, you know, tapping me on my shoulders with the sword. How, he seems to be asking himself, did I get here? And the same could be said of the mustachioed guy who's having rot grubs burrow into his arm, or the poor fool getting ripped to bits by the Achaerai in the Fiend Folio, or any of the adventurers portrayed throughout the Monster Manual and the Fiend Folio as basically a bunch of doofuses about to meet their end in an undignified way. Which one is there? An illustration that shows, a full-page illustration that shows a party of adventurers looking at a giant spider web and, like, stroking their chins wisely while a giant spider creeps up on them. That's how I would die, right? I would be in the dungeon and I'd be like, wow, that's a big spider web. I don't think I've ever seen a spider web that big, and that's when the spider would grab me. So what are some ways to make monsters that conform to the pathetic aesthetic? One way is to use vermin. So the ant, comma, giant is a fantastic pathetic aesthetic monster because the ant is literally, like, we use it, literally, it's figuratively. The ant is something that we use as a symbol for something that is pathetic and unimportant. Even a giant ant's not that big. It's not like building, stomping James Arness big. It's just awfully big for an ant. It's about the size of a dog, but maybe not like a big mean dog, maybe like a puppy. Just imagine going to your death under a wave of Cavalier King Charles Spaniels, right? There's no dignity in that. It would actually be a horrific experience. I mean, they're not big, but just imagine like a lot of little dogs biting you. That's actually terrifying. But it's not dignified. You can definitely make a bold last stand where you get swarmed on by a pack of snarling wolves. You can definitely like tear your shirt open and go mano a claw-o with a bear. But you can't maintain your pride as the giant ants swarm over you. Another way to give a monster an element of the pathetic aesthetic is to make the monster relatable as an even bigger scrub than the player characters, right? The classic example of this is the kobold. Kobolds stink on every conceivable level, both literally, I imagine they smell pretty bad, and they're just bad at everything, except perhaps for mean-spirited cunning. Getting swarmed by a bunch of kobolds is like losing control of your kindergarten class, right? What if you didn't get enough sleep last night and you stopped paying attention for just a few minutes and all of a sudden the little kids have all got permanent markers and they're... Why you allowed permanent markers into your classroom full of small children? I don't really know. That's on you in this example. But the point is, now they're running around scrawling on everything with them and they're going to scrawl on you and you know, like, yeah, you're going to get those markers back, but you are going to be covered in marker by the time you're done. Well, it's like that with a bunch of kobolds, you know. The kobolds would go and, like, hide behind the coats in the cloakroom, but, like, you'd be able to hear them because they'd be giggling. But they still might, you know, whatever, throw a tub of paste in your face before you manage to catch them. You can't maintain your dignity fighting kobolds, because if you go in, like, full hero, like, trying to be all... you know, a tough guy with a knife in your teeth or your father's sword in your hand, you're going to look ludicrous fighting these little wimps that, you know, die every time you breathe on them. And if they do get the upper hand, you're going to be running around frantically, right? It's a pathetic aesthetic monster if when it murders you, we could play Yakety Sax over the scene and it would work. Playing Yakety Sax over your final confrontation with an ancient black dragon would be subverting the scene. It wouldn't make any sense. It would be funny because it wouldn't make any sense. Playing Yakety Sax over a fight with a bunch of kobolds is perfectly in keeping with how kobolds operate. Creatures that are symbols of insignificance, creatures that are themselves pitiful, and, I mean, this goes back to what I said about kobolds. People love kobolds, right? Because, again, they're relatable, just like pathetic aesthetic characters. Or monsters that kill you in a particularly gruesome or embarrassing fashion. And this is where the pathetic aesthetic can shade into genuine horror, because one, heroic fantasy narratives frequently have, like, a relatable character who is a viewpoint for the heroic characters. Those types of characters are a feature of horror fiction, right? The idea of setting up a bunch of ordinary people to whom something extraordinary then happens. So being dissolved by a gelatinous cube while you're comrades look on in helpless horror, that's in keeping with the pathetic aesthetic. Getting mutated, that's in keeping with the pathetic aesthetic. So things that kill you gruesomely, as opposed to, like, I mean, I guess there are probably not very many non-gruesome ways to die, but in particular ones that reduce you to a state of helplessness and then kill you are in keeping with the pathetic aesthetic. Like carrion crawlers, the way they paralyze you and then something else comes along and murders you. Or the shrieker that, you know, emits a signal and you can just imagine the character, like, clanking around this cavern in his, plate armor, like, frantically trying to shush some mushrooms. I think if the word frantically comes into the description, it's probably pathetic aesthetic. The final character of monster that fits in with the pathetic aesthetic is the monster that is in itself tragic. And you could either take this in, like, a noble gothic style, or you could do it in a depressing, pathetic style. And an example of this would be Death Knights, right? To what extent are Death Knights, like, romantic anti-heroes? If they're poor, hapless dolts, then it's the pathetic aesthetic. And if they're, you know, Byronic defiers of the gods, then that's the heroic aesthetic. You can have a gothic heroic aesthetic. That's what vampire is all about. An example of this would be, to move outside of D&D for a moment, if you take a look at Warhammer, the thing that distinguishes Warhammer from other fantasy settings is chaos. And chaos partakes heavily of the pathetic aesthetic, particularly in its early versions. Like, if you look at Realms of Chaos, the champions of chaos are victims as much as they're villains. They are people who, through, you know, bad planning, bad goals, and, like, a lack of perspective, wound up being turned into monsters, and they're happy being monsters, and that's chilling because no reasonable person would be happy that way. This is most visible in the case of Nurgle. take a look at the Death Guard in Warhammer 40,000. How there's still, like, if you walk down the high street of any British town, you pass a Warhammer shop, and there will be Death Guard stuff in the window. There are four deities of chaos in Warhammer. You got Khorne, the god of war. If you can worship Khorne, like, that could be cool. You get big old spikes on your armor, and you dress all in black and red and brass, and you stick your hands in the fire, and you bathe in the blood of your foes, and that's cool. If you worship Tzeentch, that's cool. You learn the ancient magical secrets, and you have swirling cloaks of many colors, and you know things that no mortal can gaze upon and stay sane. And then there's Slaanesh, which is maybe not appropriate discussion for a family show, but believe me, it's cool with its cool outfits and its cool hairstyles and its, you know, cool makeup and tattoos and whatever. And then there's Nurgle, where, like, you're a big bloated bag of pus and a cackling demon ringing a little bell is sitting in the cavity that it's hollowed out inside your skull. Nurgle is not cool. And that's what's so cool about it. I'm coming to the realization that I've just spent 20 plus minutes saying that the pathetic aesthetic is what you get when your characters and monsters aren't cool. That'll teach me. Anyway, you can think it's not too hard to look through the monster manual and see what in here is consistent with the pathetic aesthetic, right? Aren't you dragons and liches and vampires? Obviously not, right? Vampires, they can be. You can intentionally subvert a vampire to make it contribute to the pathetic aesthetic, but in general, if you get killed by a vampire, it's either going to be tragic or heroic, and slaying a vampire is heroic. Whereas slaying a kobold or a giant beaver, or even a wolverine, is not heroic. It's pitiful. You know, you survived and you should be grateful, but you don't feel like a badass because you finally wrestled that thing to the ground and desperately stabbed it in the neck with your tent pegs. You know, you're just glad to live another turn. Now, there are players who hate this. There are players who hate what they see as having their character devalued, right? Having their conception of their character undercut. But there are players who really like it. Like, there are players who love the idea of playing a band of misfits and rascals, living by their wits, trying to survive in a world that really has no time for them, and are happy to carry that aesthetic even to higher levels. So as with any other type of aesthetic choice, this is very much a question about what you and your players enjoy. People want to play larger-than-life heroes, and that's not a bad thing. I think it's ridiculous to associate it with kids these days. It was a significant feature of AD&D 2nd, and if you think that AD&D 2nd is something that kids these days are all about, it is not my fault that you're old. It's been something that games have been striving for almost since, well, maybe not almost since the birth of the gaming industry, but, like, not too long afterward, right? You know, no one, and I think the idea of, like, condemning it for being childish wish fulfillment or whatever is one of those really weird positions to take up, like, oh, my game where I pretend to go down in a hole in the ground and get gold, that's sophisticated and mature, but your game where you go down a hole in the ground and pretend to get gold, that's dumb stuff for babies. I feel like that is a very fine hair to try and split. So I don't want to come over as making a particular aesthetic judgment. I just think that when I describe a monster as having those characteristics, I'm trying to say that it is or is not a good tool for achieving a certain aesthetic agenda. And I'd be interested to hear you, my listeners, tell me your stories of the pathetic aesthetic working or not working in a game, and which monsters and which aspects of the game you think particularly reinforce either the pathetic or the heroic aesthetics. So that, I think, is a little bit of an introduction to the idea of the pathetic aesthetic, just some thoughts of mine. I was going to do a lightning round in which I, you know, talked about what is and what isn't a monster that contributes to the pathetic aesthetic, but it's just a list of giant animal monsters and low hit die cave dudes, mainly. If it is a giant version of an animal smaller than a pair of trousers, it's probably pathetic. So thank you for listening to Monster Man. Thank you, Edwin King, for supporting this episode, and thank you to all my Patreon backers for supporting episodes like this one. If you'd like to request your own special episode of Monster Man, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 or higher level, and you'll also get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, which is about religion and mythology in fantasy role-playing games, and I think it's a lot of fun. We're doing Finnish mythology right now, and it's interesting. So thank you once again for listening. Our next regularly scheduled episode of Monster Man will be this Friday. Don't forget to vote in the Monster Man contest, which ends on the 1st of August. Thanks again. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.